We'll interrupt you as soon as we get a quorum, and we'll call the meeting to order and move your bill. So welcome to the committee, Representative Portman. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a bill that I'm going to let the City of Minneapolis explain to you. It's House File 1213 in your packet. And with that, I will introduce Michelle Jacobson.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Michelle Jacobson, appearing on behalf of the City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. House Bill 1213 really is some just quick clarifications to the prostitution statute to close some loopholes in the law as it is enacted now. The first change is outlined in lines 111 through 115, really just further clarifies what a place of public accommodation is under the statute. The current law indicates that, or other place of public accommodation is a public place under the statute, and this just further defines what a place of public accommodation is. The next change is in lines 119 through 124, which just cleans up a little bit the section that talks about prostitution occurring in public places. It really tries to make that language, the elements of that crime, mirror the misdemeanor crime of prostitution. Right now, the gross misdemeanor public place prostitution statute talks about solicitation, and does not have the same elements as the misdemeanor crime, so it's really just trying to make those two statutes analogous. And then the third proposal that we're making is in lines 2.8 through 2.28, and it's really just closing a loophole and making it that a prosecutor can charge a gross misdemeanor prostitution case when a person has a prior conviction for prostitution in a public place or for promotion of prostitution. As the law is written now, you can only be charged with a gross misdemeanor prostitution if you have a prior misdemeanor conviction. There is one additional thing you'll see in the bill as it's written up now, but that was removed and will be heard at a different time.
Members, technically there is an A1 amendment that did not meet the 24-hour amendment rule. But it is simply deleting a section, and so I don't really consider that to be substantive. So if no one objects, we will entertain the A1 amendment as soon as we have a quorum. Does anyone have any questions or concerns for the author? Representative Portman.
For you, my understanding is your intent was to refer this to finance, but I'm not sure if there's a fiscal element to the bill. I don't know if you've been notified that there's any fiscal element.
Representative Portman, we don't know if there is a fiscal element or not, and so I'm happy to refer it to finance, but if there is none, we still can put it in the public safety omnibus bill, even if it isn't in the committee's jurisdiction any longer. So it would be my intent to send it there just in case there is a fiscal cost. All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, we have Representative Portman, we don't have a quorum yet, and so I will just lay this over, and then we'll move it even when you're not in the room and send it on its way.
Okay, All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Representative Tilbury, we're going to start with you. Understand that we don't yet have a quorum. We would like you to keep in mind the jurisdiction of this committee. This is a bill that has lots of areas that it needs to go to. It's going to civil law next. It also has to go to ag as well. And so we're going to ask that you keep your comments to the areas within this jurisdiction, which would be public safety. So Representative Tilbury, it's my understanding that you have the A090136 amendment, and it's a delete everything amendment. This did meet the 24-hour amendment deadline, and so Representative Tilbury, even though we can't move the amendment yet, if it is your intention to offer that, why don't you talk to us about that amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This particular amendment is basically compromised language between the people that were stakeholders on Representative Junkie's bill and also the House File 253, which is my bill. And we also have a collection of other people that are stakeholders involved in this that have come to an agreement with this amendment. The people that are supporting this bill is a large coalition of humane societies, rescue organizations, animal control citizens, and many other breeders. We know that the problem that we're trying to cover with this bill is the inhumane breeding practices that are happening. This particular bill, we feel, presents and addresses this particular problem. I'll have testifiers available for this, and I know that we want to keep it to just the sections for this committee. And I believe that the bill, according to the amendment that's before you, Section 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are probably the areas that would affect. I'd need your guidance on that to know that for sure.
Representative Tilbury, if I might actually turn it over to Ms. Pirius, and she will talk about which areas are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Pirius.
Madam Chair, members, I've gone through the delete everything amendment that's in front of you, AO9-0136. And I've identified the criminal penalties, the application and licensing provisions that reference prior convictions, and then any provision that authorizes a peace officer to assist in an investigation. So I'll just go through page and line.
That would be great.
On page 3, line 6, under this provision, the application must include a notarized statement that identifies whether the applicant was ever convicted of animal cruelty. On page 4, lines 4 through 6, and lines 9 and 10, the board shall refuse to issue an initial license when there's been violations of those laws on lines, or their numerals 1, 2, and 4. On page 4, lines 29 through 31, the board may request a peace officer to assist in an inspection or investigation. On page 5, lines 9 and 10, their commercial breeder must comply with standards under Chapter 343 and 346, which is animal cruelty and standards of care. Also on page 5, lines 25 and 26, a commercial breeder must not knowingly hire staff or contractor who's been convicted of cruelty to animals. On page 6, lines 3 through 6, this allows a peace officer to initiate an investigation on a complaint. On page 7, lines 22 and 23, the board may revoke a license if the breeder has been convicted of animal cruelty. And on page 7, lines 29 through 30, the license must be permanently revoked if the revocation was a gross misdemeanor or felony conviction. And finally, on page 8, all of section 7 is criminal penalties.
Questions from members on which areas? Okay, members, I'm going to officially call this meeting to order. And Representative Tilbury, Representative Olin.
I will move House File number 253 be approved and referred to the Civil Justice Policy Committee.
Thank you. And Representative Olin, did you also want to move the amendment so we have the delete everything amendment before us?
Yes, I'll move the AO9-0136 delete all amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Olin. Representative Tilbury, did you have any testifiers?
Yes, I do. I have testifiers from both groups, from the groups of junkies, Representative Junkies Bill, and then my bill. I feel that that's to show that we really came to an agreement with this particular bill because we felt we needed to have that. That was kind of our charge, we felt, to be able to come to the table as a collective group. And so I have Farrell Board and Dr. Kim Culbertson, Mike Fry, Dr. Christine Gable, and Keith Strepp. But we also have a short video that we, or a DVD that we would like to show also.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if the Representative Tilbury, the Board of Animal Health has been contacted, or have they given any indication as far as testimony on this?
Representative Tilbury.
They haven't given indication that they'll testify on this, but they have been along with the process the whole way as we've discussed this with the groups and the stakeholders.
Representative Anderson.
If that could be just a snippet of just ask them to come to the testifying.
Okay, Representative Anderson, I'm happy to have them come to the testifying table, but I've asked Representative Tilbury and I'm asking members if we can keep it to the area of jurisdiction of this committee, because otherwise we're going to be sitting up here debating how many animals should or shouldn't be included, and that really is not within the jurisdiction of this committee. It is within the jurisdiction of the Ag Committee, and it's going there after civil law.
Okay.
So I'm happy to, give members some leeway, but I want to make certain that we do stick to the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Tilbury, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we'd like to show this particular video prior to my testimony coming up.
Is it short?
Very short.
All right, Representative Tilbury, go ahead. While we wait for the video to get started, members, I'd like to Representative Olin would move the A090136 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Make sure the microphone is by the She was coughing uncontrollably, and that was from the minute we got off the truck. At night, it was almost like I thought she was dying. For example, puppies' paws slip through openings in their cage floor, but Buck told her staff to only use mats when inspectors are around. Another example, dunking dogs in a tub of diluted insecticide, normally used for livestock. The label lists the hazards to humans and domestic animals. Irreversible eye damage may be fatal if swallowed, harmful if absorbed through skin.
So look at the dog is licking it.
Representative Tilbury.
Yes, thank you. And I really think that as we introduce these testifiers, the only comment that I really want to say is that I'm sure you can see from the pictures and letters and news stories that we have a problem in the state of Minnesota that we need to address, and no one can dispute that. I think it's up to us as lawmakers to make the difference. This bill goes a long way towards dealing with that problem. I do hope I have your support for that.
Representative Tilbury, we received some emails at the committee in opposition, and we've included them in the folder. And so if you want to address some of the folks' concerns that were in the email.
Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair, for reminding me that. I wanted that to be a part of the record, too, to show that there is opposition to this. Because I think anything that's important does have opposition at times, depending on how you want to look at things. This particular group of people that have sent these particular emails and so on are probably basing it on the previous bill, 253. They had not probably seen the amended version at all. So some of it won't even apply to them. Some of them are, panicking on it, thinking that the law is going to regulate them right out of business or something, and that is not the intent of this. And as they go through the amended file and see the bill itself, I think a lot of times our groups were even told as we came together and said, well, I'm looking for the amended file, and all I see, or the amended bill, and all I see is the language that we had before. I don't understand that. And so they're learning through the process that as the amended bill has come before you, that is what we're presenting today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tilbury. So if you want to get your testifiers here, and keep in mind that we are attempting to, allow time for everyone to speak, and we do have a limited time for our committee today. So please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Burl Board, and I am co-executive director of Retrieve a Golden of Minnesota, local rescue group. I am here in strong support of HF 253. Reagan is a nonprofit golden retriever rescue organization, and we have rehomed over 5,000 retrievers and mixes since 1985. 2007 was a record year for our group with the intake of over 700 dogs, 213 of which were directly taken in from inhumane breeding facilities. In the last few years, we have seen a dramatic increase in the number of our intakes from irresponsible breeders, both USDA licensed and unlicensed breeders. As the director of this rescue group, I have unfortunately become somewhat of an expert on dogs brought into rescue from irresponsible breeding practices. Reagan has become a nationally recognized authority on such intakes. We have seen distinct differences in the type of dog that comes from a reputable breeder versus dogs that come from disreputable or inhumane breeders. The types of issues we face in rescue with these rescue dogs can be broken into two categories, physical and psychological. A long list of physical issues, eye diseases, ruptured missing eyes, ear infections, hearing loss from those untreated infections, dental diseases and missing teeth, untreated fractures and wounds included embedded neck chains, every type of internal and external parasite and tick-borne disease known in veterinary medicine, debilitating fatty or cancerous tumors, scars and wounds, untreated skin infections, allergies, mange, kennel cough, pneumonia, severe respiratory disease, inguinal hernias from having too many litters, hip dysplasia and other congenital defects, dehydration, malnutrition, and severe emaciation. We also see many psychological and behavioral issues, which in my experience are equally as severe. Not uncommon are debilitating fears or phobias, a multitude of anxiety issues and compulsive disorders, and dominance issues and fear aggression. There are as many horror stories as there are dogs. Some of these rescue dogs may take years to overcome their crippling fears of common things such as food dishes, tile, carpeting, or grass even. Most of the dogs we brought in to rescue from inhumane facilities are sick, either with physical, psychological issues, or a genetic predisposition that will cause future serious health issues. They were sold or were going to be sold that way. New owners cannot know this, and as a result are duped into purchasing unhealthy animals. Over 28 states have enacted puppy mill laws, but as you know, Minnesota does not license, inspect, or regulate dog or cat breeders, even though we are one of the higher puppy-producing states in the U.S. My experience says that this industry does not self-regulate. I can give you all the rational reasons why this legislation must be passed, but at the end of the day, if you could see what I have seen, you would not be struggling with this issue. It is the right thing to do. As a Minnesota citizen devoted my life to animal welfare and rescue, I urge your support of this long overdue legislation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And other testifiers, if you can keep in mind that we're attempting to keep the scope to the public safety policy portions. We don't want to debate ag issues in here, and we don't want to debate the civil law issues. So please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Kim Culbertson. As a veterinarian who's been directly involved with the seizure and evaluation of animals from breeding facilities for almost 10 years, I am here to testify in support of House File 253. Almost every animal I have examined from breeding facilities consistently shows the same conditions and symptoms. A matted, filthy coat, wounds and scabs, overgrown nails, dental disease, ear infections, external parasites, and usually multiple species of internal parasites. The parasites that the animals carry are a particular concern since they can be transmitted to humans. Filthy living conditions, coupled with immune suppression from the stress of overcrowding, pregnancy, and lactation, increase the incidence that the animals will be carrying these parasites and shedding the parasites. Roundworm is the most common intestinal parasite found in virtually all puppies and kittens, and in people can cause blindness and infection of other body organs, including the central nervous system. Hookworms can cause itchy and painful rashes and abdominal pain and bleeding. Ringworm is a fungus that causes a scaly rash on people. Sarcopes is a dog mite that causes itchy rashes in people. Toxoplasma can cause flu-like symptoms to abortion in pregnant women. Giardia can cause severe cramps and diarrhea in people. And Salmonella bacteria can cause a range of symptoms from diarrhea to death. And the list of zoonotic diseases goes on. I would like to describe to you the medical conditions of the dogs from one of the more recent breeding facility seizures.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you now. I want you to talk about the sections that belong in this bill, not the sections that belong in the health department, not the stuff that ends up in the ag committee. We need to talk about the areas that are within the public safety policy.
Well, I hope that zoonotic disease is included in public health and safety.
That would be public health. But public safety, I believe, Representative Tilbury, you have some issues with some training and with some law enforcement things. And as we spoke about before the hearing, and I think I was pretty specific that I'd like you to stay to that. Representative Tilbury, do you have people to speak to that?
Thank you.
My last particular testifier will be the one that will talk about that.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury.
And I would also like to say, I'm going to keep my testimony very short and say that, you know, basically when you look at the issues that are before this committee, we're talking about setting a relatively low standard, a low bar, when we're asking the breeders to simply basically come up to the standards of meeting our existing cruelty statutes, as we discussed in, you know, the sections that you're referencing that do pertain to this. I'm Mike Fry. I'm the executive director at Animal Ark, and I am thrilled to be here in strong support of this amended language. I represent one of the folks who's been strongly supporting the junkie approach to this regulation, and the merged language, I believe, is actually a stronger bill than the original Tilbury bill and the junkie bill. The merged language, I think, is going to address all the issues that are before your committee in a better way, in a more coherent way, and so I strongly ask you to support it.
All right, thank you. Representative Tilbury.
Yes, I have two more testifiers. One would be Dr. Christine Gable from Minnesota Purebred Dog Breeders Association.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Dr. Christine Gable. I'm a veterinarian, PhD in environmental health, and I'm interested in dog behavior, dog bite type research. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members, for the opportunity to speak. And as a representative of the hobby breeder, I'll try to address the issues for your committee. We agree with the American Kennel Club that we oppose the concept in general of a breeding permit. However, we support reasonable and enforceable laws that protect the welfare and health of purebred dogs and don't restrict the rights of breeders and owners who take their responsibilities seriously. So this bill has the main purpose of eliminating the so-called puppy mills, and we certainly strongly support those measures. We also are somewhat concerned with the enforcement portion that hobby breeders not be negatively affected by some of that. And after some reading and some compromising, I think we're getting there. The concern is the enforceability and who is allowed to come into the kennel, what type of complaint it is that will be enforced. Do they have to be a valid complaint? Can it just be, hey, I think somebody's doing something? We do support this bill with some reservation. It's not a perfect bill, but I don't think we can ever get a perfect bill. It's not an obtainable goal, so the compromise is necessary. Giving this, we do support this as hobby breeders and as a veterinarian. I want the hobby breeders to still be there, to be a good source of healthy, wonderful dogs. And the welfare of dogs and cats would be improved both by eliminating puppy mills, but also supporting those that are already doing a good job and not unduly burdening them with excessive legislation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my last testifier is Keith Stress, Director of Humane Investigations, Animals Humane Society.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Keith Streff, and I'm the Senior Investigator for the Animal Humane Society based in Golden Valley. And my role here today is try and refocus the attention to the matter of public safety and the investigation of existing animal welfare laws. I don't feel the amendment before us today is going to significantly abrogate existing language. However, it should be viewed as a regulatory bill and not a criminal interference by government authority. I've investigated thousands of cases in well over 20 years in my role as a humane investigator here, and I believe that the commercial breeding industry is way, way overdue to have some margin of regulatory oversight on an industry that's generating multi-million dollars worth of revenue per year. With that in mind, the Animal Humane Society in Golden Valley strongly supports SF 253, and I would appreciate your vote.
All right, questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table. Please keep in mind that we're trying to limit the area of this committee's jurisdiction. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Andrea Piper. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take just a few minutes. I had a different thing I wanted to talk to you about, but since I'm just going to give a few minutes, I am a hobby breeder. I'm a veterinary technician certified by Minnesota State. I am also an animal care and control officer for the city of Minneapolis. I am a member of the Minnesota Animal Control Association. I belong to the Duluth Kennel Club, but I am a hobby breeder of French Bulldogs. Enjoy the sport of showing, since my concern is the financial part of losing our dog sport because of the bills that will create the function of us not having dogs to show. I was also concerned about the legal language that said that if I am in control of a dog, that I would then be in possession of the dog. I can only have three dogs in my city. I have three dogs in my house. But I keep control with contracts so that my dogs don't get bred to the dog down the street and the backyard breeder. Those are my controls. I'm worried about that language in that bill that says that I'm already would be guilty of a misdemeanor because I have control of the dog I have in Wisconsin and the dog I have in Dayton and the dog I have in Pamplin. Those are the dogs that I need control of to be a good breeder, to make a better breed, to make a good, healthy line. That's my concern as a hobby breeder. I'm not here as an animal control officer, but I enforce these laws. The pictures you saw, I see those animals coming from bad pet owners. They only have one animal and they can't take care of it. I don't think this is, you know, that we're going to grab all of those bad people by making a big bill. I've been told I'm just afraid of being regulated because I don't want to pay a $100 fee. I do more of that in volunteer work at the hearing and service dogs in a year. The money is not the issue. What the issue is making a person guilty of a crime when they haven't done it and actually not looking at the big picture. there are bad people out there. 5 or 10% of the breeders that I'm sure that they're out there. You can go on an internet service and find any breed you want. We're selfish people. We want what we want. Some people will accept the shelter dogs or cats. Other people want the chihuahua that Ferris Hilton has. And guess what? They're going to go on the internet and they're going to get it from Oklahoma if they can't get it from here. That's all I have to say. Thank you for hearing me.
Questions from members? All right, seeing none, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? Please come up so that I have an idea of how many there are. And please go ahead. State your name for the record.
Hearing us. My name is Susan Black. I'm the legislative liaison for the and chair for the Samoa Club of America. They say there's all this stuff going on out there, but they don't have any documentation for it. They have a case here or a case there. When I read this law, which came up on the Minnesota Pet Law List last night, it takes me out of boundaries. What I am is somebody that has a kennel with 6 dogs, but I co-own a lot of dogs. People that are really dedicated to breeding dogs, we put co-ownerships on dogs for 3 main reasons. I don't want my dogs to ever end up in a shelter. I am the owner. It won't go into an estate. It will come to me. And so they can't breed the dogs. They can't do anything because the AKC requires that everybody's name go on the litter certification and for each puppy. And I do it so that I can mentor people, so that I can teach them how to be good dog owners. This legislation takes me totally out of the picture. I'm done because I co-own enough dogs that I'm way out of those parameters, and I co-own litters. Those are not litters that happen in my house, but they are, if you read the legislation, the very top quality breeders are taken out by this. The other thing that really gets to be an issue when you have really punitive legislation is that people start to hide. I have a neighbor down the street that has a gazillion cats, and they're breeding all the time. And I tried to do something. I called Animal Arts. I called every humane society, including Golden Valley, to try to get some help with this. There's nothing that they can do. Basically, these animals have never seen a veterinarian. They are basically just running around. And I live in an area where there's wolves and coyotes and fox all over the place. No vaccination. The chief interface of rabies, of keeping rabies out of the human population, is vaccination of animals.
If I could just interrupt you for a minute. We're trying to stay on the issues that would be public safety, and that would absolutely be agriculture, the ag committee.
Rabies going into the public, into people?
Well, this is about a crime. That would be health. That would be all sorts of other areas. So do you have any comments about the areas that deal, again, you talked about the misdemeanor penalty already. That was great. Do you have any other areas that would be within the jurisdiction of this committee?
I guess the only other thing I want to say is that there are 400 bills right now that we are fighting across the country. This morning, Maine came out with one that said one dog makes you a commercial kennel, and it's $500 a year to keep an intact animal. And so, you know, these bills are being driven by the animal rights movement, and it's time that we educate legislators on what is happening here. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and keep in mind that we're trying to keep it to the area within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Committee Chairman and Committee. My name is Bonnie Taylor. I'm a concerned Minnesota taxpayer. This bill is redundant. The anecdotal evidence you've heard, the videos that you've seen, are proof that the current Minnesota laws and statutes against cruelty and neglect of animals work. They work whether you're a breeder with 5,000 dogs and enough employees to manage them, or whether you're a pet owner with a single dog, or whether you are a person on the street that kicks a kitty. The current laws work when they are enforced. And just like asking a burglar to pay taxes on his income, asking the people who are currently disobeying the law to come forward and pay these licensure fees so that they can be regulated by yet another law that they're not going to listen to is a waste of my Minnesota taxes. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Hello, my name is Robinette Dunningham-Ralston. I'm a veterinarian here in the Twin Cities Metro, and I spoke with Steve on the phone yesterday. I appreciate your time for that. I am significantly amending what I had originally discussed to try to hit the topic of interest here, so please bear with me. I do have a significant interest in reproduction. I've worked for a reproduction specialist here in the Twin Cities area. I also work in dental practice and with two different cities, animal control. So I have significant interest in dealing with reproduction, and that is not only keeping dogs intact, but it is also spay and neuter. Those are items frequently dismissed. Reproduction includes all aspects. As far as this particular bill, my main issue, which I won't go into detail on, is that it does not actually address the real problem, which is animal cruelty. What you saw today is cruelty, there's no doubt, and that's where we need to focus our efforts, so that's what I would encourage you all to do. From the standpoint of this particular committee, I do think it puts an undue burden onto some of the best breeders that I've seen and worked with. It makes it so that we are going to have less good, dedicated, large hobby kennels. Some of the smaller ones might be able to exist. My goal here is to support those people so that they don't become criminals and that we aren't wasting taxpayers' dollars going forward in an area where we should be focusing on animal cruelty and enforcing those laws. We need to have real information on how we're going to train these inspectors that are going to be going in, because a lot of variation happens even within our local animal control as to what they're going to be enforcing. A lot of it becomes personal, and we need to make sure that there's something very clear, that people have good training, consistent training. All of these things are probably more than what's in the scope of this bill right now. We do need real numbers. We need to know what we're looking at, and right now we haven't quite reached that. So I'd like to thank you for your time, and if any of you have any questions on why I do oppose this bill, I know as a veterinarian I do take a lot of flack for that because it sounds like I don't want to save puppies and kittens. And it's really that I want to do it responsibly and not in a way that's wasteful. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Elaine Hansen. I'm a hobby breeder who would not have been regulated by the original version of this bill because I have so few dogs. However, my concerns are that animal cruelty is already prohibited by law, and I see no reason whatever to impose a regulatory scheme that will cost responsible people a great deal of money and all taxpayers a great deal of money in order to prevent animal cruelty. The enforcement of the existing laws is where the emphasis should be. With respect to portions of the bill itself, I note today, which is my first time seeing it in print, that line 2.10, it defines pet dealer as anyone who has to collect sales tax for the sale of animals to the public. At 8.24, it says it's a misdemeanor for a pet dealer who did not breed the animal to possess an animal under 8 weeks. To me, that says, unless you are a commercial breeder, you cannot breed animals. This amounts to virtually the main bill that was referenced. I would also note there is some information about that main bill in and other comments that I made in an email that I sent to the committee last night. When I learned that it was not likely committee members would see my email, I wrote to the committee staff and asked that emails arriving late were arriving late, not because we didn't care, but because we had no opportunity to review the bill and submit comments and ask to be heard. The committee staff heeded that, to my great delight, and I thank them. However, they left out my email to the committee.
What was your name?
It in there. It's Elaine Hansen.
Actually, it is included, and it is...
No, only portion. The first and the very tail end of it are there. I'd be happy to send it again. It is in your email.
All right. Thank you.
There simply is not a need to regulate responsible hobby breeders. And as you will see in the message that I sent you, responsible hobby breeders can certainly have more than 20 animals. Cat breeders who have absolutely no reason to be regulated in this manner at all would fall within this trap. And I ask that you not spend Minnesotans' money passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you two the last two? If you could both come to the table so that we can... wrap this up. I don't see anyone else. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Lois Bielke. That is spelled B-J-E-L-K-E. This is the first time I've spoken in front of the committee, so thank you very much. Everything I wrote down doesn't apply, so let me know if I get off track. We are currently on our fourth and fifth dogs in our lifetime. The first three were all mixed breed, all rescues, and all had health issues. My last one was so neurotic, even though I adopted her from a shelter, and had such a serious seizure disorder that we couldn't have company over. We finally had to stop. She'd warn you, then she'd bite. We are now in our fourth and fifth dogs. I finally have the purebred Samoyeds I've wanted my entire life. Now, you come to my door, they might kiss you to death, but you're just their new best friend that they haven't met yet. I got these from a small, local hobby breeder. One of them is an intact male. Before he made a litter, we had to do x-rays. He's been to the U of M thyroid study. His thyroid is normal. He had sperm checks. He had gait movement studies. We put hundreds of dollars into this dog before it was ever decided whether or not he was going to be allowed to make puppies. He's almost 6 years old. He has been used three times for a sum total of fewer than 20 puppies. To put a breeder like this under the microscope of warrantless search and seizure and kennel standards that will be written that will probably include concrete and outdoor kennel runs is absurd. Samoyeds require close integral interaction with their people. This breed is 2,000 years old. They were bred to have no scent. They're the original three dog night dogs. Please, please, consider carefully what you are doing. The people who aren't doing what they should do aren't going to step up to this law. You cannot legislate morality. You can only legislate legality. If they're illegal already, why do you think they're going to let you bill them to get legal and cost all that money and shut them down? I wouldn't do it. I'll leave you with one last thing. It's an alteration of an old car racing joke. Do you know how you make a small fortune breeding healthy purebred dogs? You start with a large fortune. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Frank Linasa. I am the president of the Minnesota Federation of Field Fowl Clubs, which is an oversight body that represents sporting dog clubs throughout the state of Minnesota. I am a trustee for the Amateur Field Fowl Clubs of America, a 100-year-old organization that comprises of over 500 clubs nationwide. And I oversee the performance testing that goes on in North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. I, as a member of those organizations, I oppose this legislation. John Scher of MOHA asked me to make sure that I make it known that MOHA opposes this legislation as it is currently written. I have a huge problem. We were never engaged or involved in the writing of this, and it's my position that this legislation will do more to chase the good breeders in this state away than anything that has been proposed up to this point. The dog trainers in this state comprise hundreds of kennels. They have access in their kennels, 20, 30 dogs. They produce a number of litters, either in their possession or for other people, and these are dogs highly prized, huge expenses. There's very little money involved. Rather than deal with the bureaucracy that this kind of legislation would force upon them, they're simply not going to do it. The sporting dog breeds in this state will take a huge hit, I think, with this kind of legislation, and I hope that when you vote, you consider the importance of the sporting breeds within the state of Minnesota and how they make up a great fabric within our life. So thank you.
Well, I would encourage you. That is really in the Ag Committee, mm-hmm. and so you have some time. So I would really encourage you to get with Representative Tilbury and work out some of those issues, because I, too, would be very concerned about those. Yeah. So I would encourage you to contact Representative Tilbury and see if you can't take care of some of those issues that would be within the jurisdiction of the Ag Committee.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Tilbury. Closing comments, Representative Tilbury.
Yes, my closing comments As you can see, a lot of people that didn't necessarily see the amendment or read the amendment of this particular bill to totally understand what we're looking for, but we're looking for regulation to happen to give peace into the things that do exist in cases. But I think that the question that I would ask is, what good breeder is afraid to show that they're doing things for their animals that are proper? What are they afraid of? And so I guess I'm open for any questions that you might have. I think that this is a regulatory bill that needs to be passed.
Okay, members, I'd like to make an announcement that the ninth grade students from Kirkhoven Murdoch Sunberg High School are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in the Minnesota Government Tour and Education Program. So welcome to the committee. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible to have the Board of Animal Health testify on investigations or what they do?
Representative Anderson, I don't know if they're here in the room. I called for anyone in the audience who wished to testify. And
there's somebody right here.
Please come to the table. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Quintini with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. I don't need to testify.
Okay. Questions, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, ma'am, it says here in this, in the regular bill, it talks about the board, meaning the Board of Animal Health, and in the new amendment, it also references the board. What does the Minnesota Board of Animal Health do now with the issue of puppy mills or breeders or those things, as far as investigations, as far as enforcement, as far as regulating this industry?
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the Board of Animal Health currently licenses and inspects kennels, but kennels are a very particular, it's not your common understanding of the term kennel. Kennel just refers to in statute, it refers to those facilities that house dogs or that house dogs that are used for research or like humane society pounds. But it's not your boarding kennel. It's just, there are only 40 of them. It's about 40 in the state.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. According to this new amendment, it's going to give you the wherewithal to grant an operating license, and you're going to be able to oversee the license application and so forth and so on. You're also going to be able to work with local government. Do you do that now as far as supplying licenses and applications, and do you work with county governments and local law enforcement to deal with these issues?
Is it Miss Jenny?
Tini, C-H-E-N-E-Y.
Okay, Miss Tini, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, this bill would very significantly expand the scope of the board's activities. Right now, we are really only involved in the control and eradication of animal diseases of public health concern or of economic importance, such as bovine tuberculosis, anthrax, avian influenza. We have not got experience with dog and cat breeders, so this would significantly expand the scope of our responsibilities. We do have some experience with licensing programs, but we only have 50 people at the agency, and this there would be a number of staff that would have to be added, of expertise that would have to be added in order to carry out some of the responsibilities of this bill.
And Representative Anderson, that too would take place in a finance committee. Now, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 6, it talks about investigations. It says the board may initiate an investigation upon receiving a formal complaint. Do you do that now as far as investigating, or how do you handle those? Or is it basically a local government authority that does that?
Ms. Cheney.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that the board does investigate complaints against these kennels, but again, the complaints that we've had are very rare, and we haven't had to take some of the actions that are outlined in this bill. Very rarely have we had to take any actions like that. I will say that one issue that would be a little bit confusing under this bill is Section 5 references a threat to health or welfare of the animals. That's on line 6.10 of the Delete All Amendment. And that's not a term that's used generally in the industry, and we wouldn't really, it would be difficult to enforce with consistency because there is no definition of that term. So what we've done in the past has been with respect to the life of the animal, but not so much the health or welfare, because there's no definition of welfare.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Cheney, do you, right now, if a complaint is brought before you, have you ever had to go to court to testify against or on behalf of this issue?
Ms. Cheney.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I have to say that I'm not sure about that. I'd be able to, I can get you the answer to that question.
Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, I apologize for being late. I'm in another committee that's meeting right now as well. My only question is, I suspect there was some discussion about sort of the path this bill is going to take, and I understand from your comment with regard to Representative Anderson, one of Representative Anderson's questions, this is going to go to a finance committee at some point, so there will be a fiscal note at some point in time?
Yes, Representative Coles. Next it goes to civil law, then it goes to ag, then it goes to a finance committee, and I think ag policy and finance are debating who gets it, ag policy or ag finance, and then I'm certain that it will end up in some other finance committee. So it has a long way to go, Representative Coles.
Madam Speaker, these bills are always difficult for the legislatures to deal with. I recall Representative Strand, who was elected in 2002 with me and served just one term, spoke when he gave his retirement speech on the floor. He talked about one of the lessons he learned in his short time is carrying bills like this is an incredible challenge. So, Representative Tilbury, good luck continuing to move this through the process. He said he would always advise legislators to stay away from these issues because they, as you're finding out, not only do they evoke a lot of emotion on both sides, but you get to go visit every single committee, and there's a lot of them. So, good luck to you.
Representative Tilbury.
Representative Coles, I can't think of a better way to go.
Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tilbury, are there do the breeders agree to this bill? I'm assuming from some of the testimonies they don't. And then, kind of related to that question, what areas exactly were compromised in the amendment compared to the original bill?
Representative Tilbury, it might be helpful to say who was involved in the negotiations and discussions as well so that we get a clear picture of who you've been working with. Representative Tilbury.
Madam Chair, Representative Drzkowski, we have several groups that have been a part of both bills, the Jahnke bill and the Tilbury bill. And the charge basically was we need to come to some kind of agreement with the collection of stakeholders that they have. And so when we talk about all breeders, we're not going to have consensus on all breeders to have this particular bill be passed if I had to have consensus of everyone. I'm finding that out, just like Representative Coles had made reference to. But to mention all of the people that are involved in this, there's numerous. And so, I mean, I can provide you with a list of all of them if that would help you out. But, I mean, there's just a tremendous total. And I tried to make sure that the testifiers that we brought today reflected the spirit of bringing together two groups of people that have spent a lot of negotiation time. Plus, I have to add that we're still working with the larger commercial breeders on their concerns for our next visit. And they're 95% of the way there in that particular case, but we're still working on the 5% to get those people along with. So I guess I can't really answer that to the way I think it should be.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury. Questions from members? Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I forget, I'd request a roll call on the vote at the end of the day. I was kind of taken back by the testimony. I remember the veterinarian who talked about dental diseases and parasites and rashes. You know, I don't even know if I take care of those on myself. Are we blending the lines between people and animals here? Are these, I guess I would have a question maybe for anybody, maybe the author of the bill or maybe Ms. Cheney about the section that talks about the board or a veterinarian being required to go out and do an inspection, and if they're going to go out and inspect the teeth of a dog and then come to the conclusion by inspecting the teeth of a dog that somebody is going to be faced with a criminal proceeding, that's very problematic. I struggle with where this bill is going, so I'd be interested in any comments that people may have in that regard.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Streff. I'm the investigator with the Animal Humane Society in Golden Valley. Representative Brzezinski, I'll try and answer that for you. I don't think collectively any inspection is going out and looking at the immediate health of individual dogs. Typically, the breeders and the animals that are produced by the breeders that are creating the problems that necessitated this type of regulatory bill are producing animals with those types of conditions that have subsequently been seized in some type of criminal intervention. The veterinarian testifying on behalf of that works in our on our staff at the Animal Humane Society, and she was testifying on the some of the conditions that the animals are suffering from that are symptomatic from the environment they were removed from. On cases that I've handled, working with local jurisdictions in taking animals off of these types of properties.
Follow up, Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've got several questions here.
Well, Representative Cole is going to have to move if he wants me to see you.
Okay.
I can't see.
I don't want
to
chip on me.
Okay. Hey, Representative Cole, I didn't tell you which one of the three it was.
All right, Representative Driskowski. We do have Representative Cornish and Representative Olin on the list as well, Representative Driskowski.
Okay, my next question, thank you, Madam Chair, is related to the investigations, Section 4 of the bill. Is that the bill, is that section of the bill that was struck? I'm trying to remember, was there a Section 4 struck, or was that the last bill? That must have been
the last one. Bill.
Okay. Section 4, I'd be interested in maybe some commentary from an actual peace officer. And the question is this: it seems apparent that if these people are going to have to go out and execute these investigations, is that going to take our peace officers out of the realm of protecting the life and liberties of people and going out instead of and making these judgments on dogs and cats and compromising our ability to truly protect public safety?
Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Rastowski. I think my testifier would be able to answer that question for you.
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Brzezinski, I'm going to have trouble with your name.
Alphabet's fine.
I apologize for that. I also work as a peace officer for another agency on a part-time basis, and I don't see that my authority is being taken away from human aspect. I see myself as a police officer to investigate and subsequently enforce the statutes of the state of Minnesota, and a violation of the animal welfare law would be one of those duties.
Representative Driskowski.
Madam Chair and Officer Andreff. Scriff, thank you. I guess I wasn't asking about your authority. I was talking about your time and your ability to focus the limited time resources that you have on the safety of the public.
Mr. Scruff.
Madam Chair, I understand that. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how one interprets it, officers seldom get a chance or a choice to decide which statutes they'd rather enforce or investigate. Typically, in my role as a humane investigator, as I'm here today, if we receive a formal complaint regarding allegations of abuse, neglect, cruelty, or torture, or any of the other atrocities regarding the care and welfare of an animal, we respond to that complaint. And one of the first responses is for me to contact that local area of jurisdiction, whether it be a sheriff's department or a local police department, depending on the location of the alleged violation. And I will work in concert with that department and that officer to subsequently follow up on those allegations to confirm whether or not there is an issue. And the existing animal welfare has a myriad of statutes that defines what you can and cannot do with a pet or companion animal.
Those of you who have your cell phones on in this committee room, please turn them off. Please go ahead.
And at that point, we would investigate, and if there is a crime, which in, according to the bail schedule of existing language, will go from anywhere from a petty misdemeanor to a felony offense, depending on the severity of the offense. So those officers are usually interested in looking into those allegations if they are indeed serious.
Representative Drazkowski, final question? Sure. And then I'll move on to Representative Carson. We can come back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Related to that, though, again, I sense some evasion for my question here. My question is, as a peace officer, are those peace officers going to be, by the nature of the fact that we seem to be expanding the purview of their duties to include investigations into I'm still trying to understand exactly what, but some of the production practices of different dog and cat breeders, are we going to, by nature of expansion of their duties, going to be limiting their ability or taking time that they might have used as an individual to otherwise follow up on complaints that that are related to the public safety and protection of liberties of people?
Mr. Strauss.
Madam Chair, the answer, in my opinion, is no. If this law were, this bill were to pass tomorrow, I don't think there would be any significant differential in how we currently are investigating cruelty complaints. So this afternoon and tomorrow, when I'm working on cases, I'm still going to be contacting those officers. I'm still going to be working in concert with those jurisdictions to investigate alleged violations of existing animal welfare law. This will give us, this bill, if passed, will give us a better tool to regulate that and hopefully take pressure off those local jurisdictions, because on a yearly basis they will be inspected, licensed, and regulated. Today they are not.
Representative Cornyn.
I'll pass.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd just like to point out that what we're voting on in public safety today is the public safety aspect of this bill. A lot of the questions on may the board may inspect, et cetera, are going to have to go to either ag policy or ag finance, because they're clearly agriculture questions. When you ask the Board of Animal Health to do something, that's under either ag policy or ag finance. It's not in this committee.
And members, that is actually one of the things that I did request of the author as well. If he had amendments that didn't really relate to what we were attempting to do here, that he kept in mind that those are rightfully within the ag committee. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Olin, we don't, I appreciate the chair's effort to keep the debate to the public safety issues, but the fact, Representative Olin and members, is that we got to vote on the whole bill. We don't get to just vote on the public safety pieces. So I appreciate the effort to try to keep the focus of this committee on the public safety issues, but even if I don't have problems with those or support those, and I don't support the bill, I'm voting on the whole bill, as is each member here. So Representative Olin, I appreciate your comments. I just think they're a little misplaced.
Representative Olin.
Madam Chair, I agree with Representative Coles. You can vote on the whole committee. All I'm saying is we shouldn't be doing an hour's worth of committee time discussing issues that are clearly going to have to be discussed in ag if it does come out here.
Follow-up question, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lines 8.24 through 8.28, it talks about, and one of the testifiers brought up misdemeanor for a pet dealer who's not a commercial breeder to knowingly possess an animal age of 8 weeks or less. And then there's a qualifier there. This restriction does not apply to humane societies, nonprofit organizations performing the function of humane society, or a local animal control authority. I guess I would ask any of the testifiers, does that include PETA and the Humane Society of the United States?
Mr. Stress.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, currently PETA and Humane Society of the United States are not contemporary operating animal humane societies. They don't take any animals in and they don't put any animals out. That all falls on the programs and services provided by local, community, district humane societies working within the communities with the people that have displaced or neglected or unwanted animals.
Representative Drozdowski?
So, Madam Chair, I would ask Mr. Schreff.
Yes,
okay, thank you. If PETA and Humane Society of the United States are not animal welfare organizations, how would you classify them as animal rights organizations?
Madam Chair, yes, I would. They are an animal rights organization that collectively supports the various philosophies and ideologies that are much farther to the left in regards to animal care and maintenance than are your typical open admission contemporary humane societies doing work specifically to Minnesota. Thank
you. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is going to be very short. I'd like to point out for the record that to get out of public safety policy today, I will vote for it. That does not mean if it comes to ag policy in its present form that I'll vote for it.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schilder, just a quick comment and question. I think the intent of your bill is very good. I come from a unique perspective. My grandfather raised German Shepherd dogs, and I have two rescue dogs of my own. So I hear that the Purebred Dog Breeders Association is supporting the bill, but we have these hobby breeders who are not a part of this association, or are they just, are you still working on that?
Representative Tilbury.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, we're still working with a lot of people.
Okay.
And once again, just to reiterate, we're going through a long process, and each level we go to, we find new people that have something to be concerned about. And so we're trying to make sure that this bill does do the intent.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Holstrom.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Bigham.
Aye.
Representative Cornish. Representative Drozdowski.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Cass.
Aye.
Representative Kelly.
Aye.
Representative Coolidge Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Coles.
No.
Representative Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Owen.
Aye.
Representative Tamar.
Aye.
Representative Rosenthal.
Aye.
And Representative Szymanski.
No.
Thirteen in favor, four against. The bill passes. Thank you, Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, before we had a quorum, Representative Hortman already presented her bill, so I would move that House File 1213 be recommended to pass. Be re-referred to the public to finance with the recommendation that it go to Public Safety Finance Committee. And then, members, there is an A1 amendment in your packet, and that simply deletes section or page 2, section 4, and that's what doesn't have to go to Representative Molly's committee. They're taking out the civil issue. So, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, the chair renews her motion that House File 1213 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance with the recommendation that it go to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, we have House File 819. Is Representative Atkins in the room? She's presenting a bill. So, and Representative Bingham's next, and I think she's presenting a bill. So, Representative Mullery, do you want to go next? And Representative Mullery, it's my understanding that you want House File 497 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Representative Mullery. Thank you. Representative Mullery, are you having a omnibus data practices bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and so this goes there.
So Representative Mullery wants the bill to go back to the Civil Law Committee. That's what I thought.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Mullery,
who wants the? Is this set up for another or?
They'll take it down, Representative Mullery. Representative Mullery, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is the same as the bill that passed out of the House before. And it just, what it does is it gives probation officers the authority to get information when they have to go into a probationer's home. They can find out if he's on the list of people who are entitled to possess guns. And we have today Mr. Cal Murray, the head of the Probation Officers Association.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kelvin Sari. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association. At sometime after the beginning of the current session, each of you as members of the Public Safety Committee received a document that looks like this from the Minnesota Corrections Association, which is purely their legislative agenda and a number of position papers. From time to time, the Minnesota Corrections Association representing probation officers, parole officers, administrators, and vendors as well, do take positions and on certain pieces of legislation. This particular piece of legislation we were soliciting last year and we got a late start on it, but was unable to process through at least the Senate side. So we've appreciated Representative Mullery picking this up and trying to move this through this year. There are two reasons that are indicated as documentation in the handout that we've given you today, which comes from our policy booklet, as the reason for this request. The first deals with doing pre-sentence investigation reports. More and more we're hearing from our officers throughout the state that judges are wondering why we are not addressing the gun permit issue, who's holding gun permits when they're coming through the court system. So as probation officers are doing pre-sentence investigations reports, it should be included in that report whether the person holds a gun permit, and depending on the type of offense that they're convicted of and being sentenced on, they may lose their right to have that permit. The statute, as you can read in our material, is somewhat vague. In some cases, does give probation officers the right to access to this material, but specific research has said that 624 does not at the present time provide for access for probation and parole officers to that information. So it would simply be a good a measure to address that at the time of the sentencing, so the judge would have that information, could include it in the specific conditions, and it would just be a cleaner aspect in dealing with the sentencing process. The other portion of that deals with personal officer safety, and that's something we talked about last year with this and in Representative Mulry's committee earlier today, this year, just having the knowledge of who has gun permits becomes a real good factor for our officers who are working as intensive supervision agents who are knocking on doors 24 hours a night. And this is taking place both in metro and in rural Minnesota. And are concerned about officer safety all the time. And this isn't going to be a catch-all, of course, by having access to has permits, but it would go a long way in helping us to make decisions on how to approach a certain offender that may be in a home, knowing that there could be guns available to them. So with those two reasons, we're asking for support for this legislation.
Representative Cole.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Either for Representative Mullery or for your testifier, I'm not sure that I have any problems with supporting this in light of the testimony that was just given, but if I look at line 1.10, we're not only including parolees or probationers, but also defendants. In other words, somebody who may have been accused or charged with a crime, but not yet not yet convicted of anything. Why are we including defendants? Help me understand that and see if I can come up with some level of comfort so I can support this.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, well, first of all, as Mr. Sari explained, judges want to know it before the pre-sentence investigation. I believe they also sometimes want to know that on the conditions of when they're released prior to trial. And another is my understanding is that sometimes they also, and Mr. Sari can explain, but sometimes they have to go out and actually watch these people during the release period before trial.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, the word defendant came into use because of the pre-sentence investigation aspect of it. The person still called as a defendant, even though they may have pled guilty to a particular offense. Sentencing has been deferred by the court pending a pre-sentence investigation report. So within the system, we still call that a defendant until such time as they're sentenced.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I appreciate that clarification. I think we need to change that word. I understand that's how you use the term, but I'm not comfortable having this applied to people who have not yet been convicted, absent at least hearing hearing something. I don't have a problem. I mean, if somebody's convicted of a crime and you guys need to understand that, I get that. But a defendant has much broader common usage than the pre-sentence investigation situation that you're describing, where you may still call them a defendant, but they have nonetheless been convicted.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Coles again, the main concern for that would be that having access to this permit would also be in effect for those officers who are doing not necessarily the intensive supervision work, but we have many officers throughout the state that are doing pretrial work where they're placed by the courts under supervision, under pretrial supervision, and those conditions as well would are a matter of personal officer safety.
And Madam Speaker, I appreciate that. I think we need to, or Madam Chair, excuse me, I want to give you either a desired or maybe not desired, given our situation, a promotion. Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, again, that makes sense to me, but not every defendant is in that situation, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with the language as broad as... I think we can come up with language to get at what you're talking about, so, whether it's... whether we're specifically identifying somebody who's been put on court-ordered, some kind of court-ordered supervision prior to trial or some kind of requirement like that. I think we can come up with the language and fix it, but it's just too, I think it's too broad in its current form.
Representative Cornyn.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery of... wait till you get done. Representative Mullery, maybe a suggestion, and then one problem. I don't have a big problem with your bill here, but a permit holder is also a defendant convicted and awaiting sentencing or something like this would help out, because that would cover the pretrial or the pre-investigation. And the other thing is between now and where this travels, my other worry is that if you could see in what other situations people have access to records, if there was some language about how to be used in the official scope of your employment, this information, something like that. I want to offer an amendment today, but just a couple of things to think about as it travels. Maybe a defendant upon conviction and awaiting sentencing, and then the counsel could help with the rest of the sentence, but make it fit.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, the second one I don't see any problem with. I certainly don't think, I think that would be it, but the first one doesn't, they can't agree to, because awaiting sentencing doesn't cover everything, because of the fact that sometimes judges will want to know this background investigation before they even release them prior to trial. So we can't talk about what you're talking about, because that would not cover the situation in that case. And in other cases, they actually assign them during that period of release prior to trial. They're assigned to do some type of, and I don't know if it's labeled supervision or not, but they have to keep track of them. So we can't take your first one because that would take out part of the importance of this. But the second part, of course, I see no problem with.
Representative Jackson?
My question is for the testifier and Representative Mullery. I had the same concern about the word defendant, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's answered by the context, and that is you have to have a status of being under the authority of a probation or parole officer first, and it's only those defendants who are under that jurisdiction because there are release, their involvement is because of pretrial release terms or pre-sentence investigation. So it's not any defendant, it's only those defendants who have already been placed under the jurisdiction of parole or probation, correct?
Mr. Sari.
Madam Chair, Representative Jackson, that's absolutely correct.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair and Representative Jackson. I'm getting different things from different probation officers on it. I've been told by some probation officers that sometimes they are asked by the court to do a study like this, including whether they have a gun permit, before they place them on release. So before they are released pending trial, they have to do an investigation, which would be for your situation of coverage during the release.
Members, Representative Cornish and Representative Cole, would you be willing to work with Representative Mullery to try to work this out? Because it's going to civil law and data practice is kind of when you access the data. It's not necessarily really the public safety section of it. So would you be willing to work with Representative Mullery on some language between now and civil law? Representative Coles, Representative Cornish.
Always happy to help, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 497 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Atkins. The chair moves that House File 819 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out of respect for the committee's time, I do have a delete all amendment and then an amendment to that. If we can put it in the shape that the author would like to proceed, if the chair would move to delete the DE1, my understanding that it's acceptable to the chair as well as the minority.
That's correct. Representative Adkins did not meet the 24-hour rule, but I have spoken with the other side, and everyone is fine with the timeline being waived. So Representative Adkins moves the chair moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Adkins, what other amendment do you need?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Peace in the Valley. Line 1.6 would, after the word A, it would add the word sporting event, comma.
Repeat that, please, Representative Adkins.
Line 1.6, after the word A, it would add the words sporting event, comma.
Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill, with the amendment, we have peace in the valley with all the folks that care about this bill. It was actually, being that it's St. Patrick's Day, the Celtic Women had a concert. Some people think this was brought on by Bruce Springsteen out in New Jersey. The Celtic Women actually had a concert. They put some tickets up for sale. The allegation was made that those tickets were never made, or many of those tickets were never made available to the public, even though they were supposed to have been. And that, in this case, Ticketmaster deviated from practice, took the best tickets, and put them on their secondary site without ever making them available for sale to the public. That's not fair. Ticketmaster denies that allegation in fairness to them. That said, they do not oppose this bill with the language that is provided, which says that you can't do that. But if they're not doing that, they got nothing to worry about. The teams like it because it allows them to direct how their tickets are sold. It also says that they cannot be diverted to a secondary site without being first made available along the lines of what the team said, or the concert promoter, or the venue, which is that they should be made available to fans at face value. After that, if they go on the secondary market and they're scalped and all of that, that's a whole separate discussion. But at least you get one shot to buy your tickets at face value. The second thing that the bill does is it says you can't sell tickets ahead of time that you ain't got. And that's what's happening in the market right now. You've got, I think it was the Vikings were telling me, or the Twins, that they've got tickets that go online for sale that are two rows above the very top row in the Metrodome by some of these folks who shall go unnamed, but they put sales tickets up for sale that they don't even got in rows that don't exist. And that causes a problem, obviously, for the venues and for the teams as well. With that, I don't believe that there's anyone that wants to testify because we do have Peace in the Valley, but I'd be happy to hear from them, or I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions from members. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm just asking a question on this amendment. You did an oral amendment for line 1.6. Do you also have to put that same verbiage on 1.11 or not?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Madam Chair, yes. It's a good thing we have a reviser right here next to us. On line 1.11, Madam Chair, if you'd be so kind as to move after the word A, the insertion of the word sporting event, comma.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Representative Taft.
That is my statement.
All right. Seeing no further questions, the Chair renews her motion that House File 819 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank
Representative
you,
Eakin. Now, members, Representative Eakin has a big bill before us, but we are going to limit his discussion to the items within the jurisdiction of this committee as well. So the Chair moves that House File 1237 be recommended to pass and sent to the Civil Justice Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Eakin. It's my understanding that you have the A4 amendment as well. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct.
The Chair moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Eakin.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. The two sections that your committee would deal with are sections 11 and 13. And section 11 says that when approaching and passing law enforcement watercraft, with its emergency lights activated, the operator of the watercraft must move away from the law enforcement watercraft and maintain a slow, no-wake speed while within 150 feet of it. The Section 13, the taking of wild animals to protect public safety, what this says is that a licensed peace officer may take a wild animal that's an immediate threat to public safety. And that's the two sections that it deals with. The amendment that's been offered deals with Section 13, and the amendment simply ensures that if a peace officer does take a wild animal to protect public safety, that the evidence is protected and turned over to the conservation officer.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the Chair renews her motion that House File 1237 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks, Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Is Representative Eastland in the room? Oh, Representative Liebling. Members, that motion was as amended. So do I need to renew that motion? I do need to. Representative Eakin, I need to renew the motion that House File 1237 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, I have a delete all amendment as well, which I...
Representative Liebling, it's my understanding that transportation policy has just requested this bill, so
yes.
It won't be laid over. So the Chair would move that House File 1164 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. And then the Chair will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is actually a fairly simple bill, and I have a testifier here who will explain it and discuss it a little bit. I believe that Representative Lesch is know if he's on this committee, but
yeah.
Oh, there he
right
is.
There.
He's hiding behind his computer. Representative West, I understand this is basically a bill that you carried a few years ago, so here I am carrying it today. But anyway, I will let my testifier introduce herself. And,
please go ahead and state your name for the record. Representative West. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kelly Keegan. I am a private criminal defense attorney practicing all over the state. I'm here to testify about House File 1164. Essentially, what this bill would do is a Department of Public Safety bill. Basically, right now in the state of Minnesota, there are several reasons under which a person's license can be suspended or revoked. There's quite a lengthy list of reasons why that can happen. Assuming a person then gets suspended or revoked, what happens is if they then drive while they're suspended or revoked and get stopped by police, get charged with a new offense of driving after withdrawal, meaning suspension or revoked, they go to court, they plead guilty thinking that they're going to wrap up this, take care of this offense. But what happens is that they oftentimes don't realize that by pleading guilty, they will incur a further suspension or revocation. And so what happens is they go out, they say, you know what, I went to court, I handled this, I took care of the problem. They then leave there, go out and drive, not knowing that the court has now sent notice to the Department of Public Safety to further suspend or revoke them. So people get stopped again. They go to court again, and they think that they're going to take care of the problem, but they don't fully understand why they are continually being suspended or revoked. Quite frankly, to me, this bill is sort of the revolving door bill. It's the people who keep coming back to court over and over with this problem. Yes, the Department of Public Safety often sends notice saying you've been convicted of this new offense, you're going to be further suspended or revoked. But for whatever reason, you know, people don't open their mail, they don't have a current address on their driver's license, they don't realize. I oftentimes have people come to me seeking private counsel saying, I have no idea what is going on and why I keep continuing to be suspended or revoked. And I have to explain to them, and sometimes it's the first time that they realize this or see this. Now, included in the list of these offenses is a failure to pay a fine, for example, or failure to appear in court. Both of those will trigger a license suspension. A few years ago, there was a change made in the law so that the Department of Public Safety says if that's the reason why a person's license is suspended or revoked, then we're not going to... If they go to court, they get caught driving after suspension with no license. When they go to court and plead guilty, we're not going to further suspend their license. We're going to sort of stop the revolving door. Now, in that past, the Department of Public Safety, I think, has wanted to code these offenses differently. It was an administrative nightmare to try to go back and say, well, why is this person suspended or revoked? Is it because they didn't pay a fine or because they didn't appear? This amendment, the author's amendment, would essentially say, let's stop the revolving door. A person, you know, can have an offense where they're suspended or for whatever reason they're suspended, get that suspension, go to court, deal with it, and be done with it, not have to come back over and over and over in court. Judges and prosecutors oftentimes comment on this and talk about that it is a big problem in having people come back through the court system over and over again. You know, I want to be very clear, too, that we're not asking that there should be no consequences for driving without a license. What we're saying is, let's have a little common sense in saying, okay, a person's going to have a license suspension, but then let's end it after that. Let's not keep having these people come back. You know, and I want to be very clear, too, that I know that public safety is often a concern. We say, well, we don't want people driving without a license. They shouldn't be driving, end of story. But there are reasons that have nothing to do, quite frankly, with the actual public safety. I mean, for example, if a person's license is suspended because they failed to pay child support, that doesn't have anything to do with actual driving conduct. They could then get suspended. A person could go, you know, be sitting at a stoplight. Police officers could run their license and say, this person doesn't have a valid license, charge them with an offense, and then they get put in this system where they're over and over and over again. The other thing that I would say, too, is that what's happening in the court system right now is that judges, in an attempt to sort of fix this, are circumventing this process. They're saying, you know what, we're not going to convict this person of the offense. We're going to set it up so that, frankly, there's no conviction, which doesn't trigger the additional suspension. And I don't think that's what was intended when this law was originally enacted, to say, okay, instead what we're going to do is have these people's offenses dismissed. like I said, judges and prosecutors, there are several of them that are in support of this bill because they say, let's get these people off this treadmill. And so with that, I would just leave it to questions.
Questions from members? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Living, just a couple of questions now. So this delete all is the new bill.
Yes.
So all that says mm-hmm. in the back, the only change then to this whole section about the licenses mm-hmm. would, the law would now read, the commissioner may not suspend the driver's license of an individual who is convicted of a violation of section 171.24 sub 1, which is
driving after suspension. It's
okay.
Not revocation or cancellation, it's suspension. Right, that's your understanding, right? Yep.
So all this bill would, excuse me, Madam Chair, so all this bill would do, the whole bill would be that if a person gets tagged for driving after suspension for any reason, they can't really suspend them again on that, him or her again in that reason. It doesn't have, the preliminary hearing and the other stuff, the original bill is thrown out then?
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, that's correct. That's correct. It's limited to that now. You know, we may find that actually we need to make it broader, but, you know, this is a start. And this is something that I think is, I had hoped to have a prosecutor here today to talk about it. I wasn't able to get one today, but I think a lot of prosecutors and judges do support this as well, because, as my testifier stated, it does really kind of just clog up the courts. One of the issues right now, of course, is that we're in this situation where the courts are financially strapped and looking for ways to kind of streamline what they do. And eliminating this revolving door is one of those little tools that we would have.
Representative Cornish.
Well, I agree, Madam Chair, Representative. I'd like it to get throughout the preliminary hearing because all you're doing is shifting the burden then onto the state to have the preliminary hearing. And this is actually better than the original one. So, but the judge, I imagine, still could have the power. It says the commissioner may not suspend, but the judge, if he thought it was an egregious case and he had enough of this continual, he could put the person in jail or suspend him on his own. But this would keep the automatic suspension from the commissioner from happening. It would have to be a judge's intervention that would make it.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, that's my understanding, because this is now, these would now be on the payables list anyway, as I understand it, which means that most of these people won't be showing up in court, but there's certainly nothing to stop a prosecutor from charging the person if they have repeated violations or something like that, bringing them into court and convicting them. And I think judges can suspend licenses. I'm not sure about that part of your question, though. Maybe somebody else knows the answer to that. Whether I've never seen judges do that, maybe only because they don't need to.
Representative Cornish.
I'll pass. I don't really care. I guess I like it the way it is. I don't care what the judge says after this.
Thank you. Further questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Ryan. I work in the Department of Public Safety within the Office of Traffic Safety. This bill that was proposed was not a Department of Public Safety bill, but I'm here on behalf of the Department of Public Safety and the Office of Traffic Safety and the Minnesota State Patrol to talk about this bill and kind of the consequences of it. People that get their license suspended have demonstrated extremely dangerous driving behavior. These are people that have multiple speeding violations, other types of violations on the roadway, fleeing a police officer, no insurance, driving a driver's license without any, not having a license, and driving on the road, having the proper restrictions on a driver's license. They're all very extremely dangerous driving behaviors. They put everyone's life in danger on the roadway, including yourself. People that continue to drive after their license has suspended need to understand that there are consequences for that behavior. And that driving is a privilege to those that decide to obey the law. That this bill weakens the integrity of the licensing system and endangers everybody on the roadway.
Question from members. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I agree with a lot of what you say, but you have to admit you have a mess on your hands now, because we're sitting on the side of the road with these defendants, and they've got these driving after suspension things they're trying to wade through. Suspensions for fines unpaid, suspension for lack of insurance, suspension because of suspension. And we're trying to help them weed through it. And you keep building the suspensions, and it leaves the defendant, even though he or she might be a real bonehead or not a bad person, just screwed up, but it throws everybody into this revolving wheel, and it's got to be settled somehow. So maybe this is the pressure that will bring about some resolution, but something's got to be done.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, I agree. We actually don't take further suspensions for unpaid fines or any kind of court order. What we do have is a committee that is actually looking at this particular issue and trying to develop some kind of a system that actually maintains public safety and understands that there is people that continue through the process, continue as a revolving door, and we need to make sure that there is a way of getting out of that revolving door.
Representative Cornish.
Do you still have a compact agreement with other states that you're revoking licenses because of activity in other states? Is there that deal that goes to that reciprocity still, that if somebody doesn't pay their fines or something that's in the compact agreement with Minnesota, that we revoke them here because of activities in another state?
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, we still do have that compact agreement, but again, that is for unpaid fines. We will receive other violations as well that would come in, like if you got a ticket from another state, we would have that violation would come over to your Minnesota driving record.
Representative Cornish.
And suspension because the child support payment's not paid. Is that one of the things that we would suspend for, do you know? I mean, that you get ordered to suspend?
From another state?
No, from our state.
From our state? Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, we do suspend for unpaid child support.
Madam
Representative Cornish.
The point I'm trying to bring forth is, I mean, I'm all for busting these people who are doing really bad things, because this is a mess. We got too many ways to suspend people and not enough way to get back to licenses for the people that are goofing up.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Ms. Ryan or Representative Liebling. Just inquiry, maybe to that same point, what is our ultimate penalty? I understand this is a deterrent. Suspension is a deterrent. But is there an ultimate penalty for those who just are chronic and that suspension isn't really an issue for them?
Ms. Ryan, or Representative Wayling, either one.
Right. Well,
Madam Chair,
Representative Kelly. No, these are still misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor offenses. I mean, what the testifier mentioned, for instance, fleeing a police officer, I think that I think it's a gross misdemeanor offense, can even be a felony offense. So to say that there aren't any penalties for these things is really misleading, because the court is still dealing with them. You're still at least getting a fine. As I said before, if it's a chronic offender, for instance, the prosecutor wants to charge them separately, they can certainly do that. They can bring them to court. They can go to jail for all of these things, at least as a misdemeanor, and maybe even to prison if it's a felony. So it's not as though there are no consequences. The only thing we're trying to do here is keep the consequence for a... And by the way, let me back up. You'll still get your license suspended for these things that the testifier mentioned. It's only if you're then later charged with driving after suspension, all my bill does is say, then you don't get another suspension for that. You still have a suspension for the underlying offense, and you still have to deal with that. We're just trying to not pile on suspension after suspension.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, maybe just misunderstood my question. That was my question. What is the, is there a stiffer penalty instead of just suspension that we can move to quicker in these chronic instances that we go after suspension? That was simply my question.
Representative West.
Representative Kelly, in Ramsey County, and I know that it's the practice is similar in Hennepin. We treat first ones as a petty, and then typically we move into misdemeanor on second or third. On the fourth one, we give 15 days jail time, and then stack 3 days for every offense thereafter. So if someone comes in and they've got 10 on their record, which is an infrequent one I see, we'll give 15 days for up to number four. and then 6 times 3 is 18. So they're doing 33 days in jail on number 10, and just gets more as you go down the pike. From my perspective in Ramsey County, if there's a deterrent for these types of people, it's not the license revocation or suspension. It's the jail time, if anything. Oftentimes, the jail time is not even a deterrent.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, then, to follow up on that, isn't this kind of a marker, then, for you? I mean, if we take away the suspension rules, doesn't that help in the processing of that to say, well, if you've got 1 through 5 suspensions, now we move on up the ladder?
Representative
Black. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kelly, I don't know if I totally understand your question, but it's a marker in terms of it being helpful. There's two different types of folks. There are those that actually want to get their license back, and then there are those that don't care. For those individuals that actually want to get their license back, the recurring suspensions are a problem. For the ones that don't care, nothing's going to help. Does that kind of answer your question?
And Representative Kelly, I think I understood your question. Your question was, if they suspend the license, isn't that what helps add up so that you get 3? Whether or not you get stopped, you count that as a suspension. So you'd get stopped, you'd get a ticket for driving after suspension or go to court for that. They just wouldn't extend the suspension, so you'd still be racking them up. You just wouldn't be getting the suspension in addition.
Thank you.
Further questions from members? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1164 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Eastland. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Eastland. Members, Representative Eastland did not meet the 24-hour rule, but the reason he didn't is because he got very short notice that he was going to have this bill on the agenda. So we've also talked to the members, and they don't have an issue with the fact that he didn't meet the deadline. So, Representative Anderson, did you want to move the bill, or do you want me to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I move House File 1126.
All right. Representative Anderson moves House File 1126 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. And Representative Anderson moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. This is a bill that basically is the most important thing that it's doing is it's extending a sunset. There's a program that was started in 2005, the Conditional Relief Program in the Department of Corrections that allows certain drug offenders to be able to get into a program where they can get a little bit of an early release and if they go through the right hoops and under some supervision, we can get them out of the prison a little bit faster. And save some money. There was a report that was done in 2000 that was given to the legislature in 2008 by the Department of Corrections, and it basically explains what's been done so far. There have not been a lot of people that have been in the program. About 2,500 were screened for CRP. There's been about 49 that this was as of 2007 that were actually have gone through the program and have gone into an early release supervisory program. There has been some savings, according to the report, about $218,000 of savings to corrections. And I think what I'm concerned about is this is an option that I think we need to keep open and look at as we put more and more people into our prison system. There are certain ones that could benefit by getting some treatment and getting some help and getting back into society in a supervised fashion. It would be good for them. It would be good for us financially. And this program has demonstrated that so far. And so what this bill does is it makes a few minor changes and extends the program for another 2 years beyond the current sunset in law, which is set to expire this year. So I've got some testifiers that can talk a little more intelligently about the bill.
All right. We have technically 7 minutes left in the committee. We have your bill and another one after this. So I suggest you keep that in mind as you proceed. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender.
I was a member of the Legislative Working Group on Controlled Substances that reported back to you in January, and we reported that we just about couldn't agree on anything at all, that everything was voted on in the working group 8-7 or 9-8 or 8-8, and we just didn't agree. But the one thing that passed unanimously in that group was that this early release program ought to be extended. In addition, I'd like to say a little something about Section 1. Section 1 removes the mandatoriness of a six-month jail or prison sentence for a violator with a controlled substance crime in the fifth degree, the lowest degree, if they had a previous drug crime. Being replaced in the bill with a provision that either the prosecutor or the judge on their own motion could depart from the mandatory 6 months if they state substantial and compelling reasons. Partly that's based on a Court of Appeals case that's being passed out called State v. Cobb from December. Ms. Cobb was a woman who was a previous controlled substance offender. She was clean for 2.5 years and was then caught with a trace element, and the court determined that she should be put on probation because she'd been clean for so long and had some other good qualities. However, the Court of Appeals said that they had to impose the mandatory 6 months. However, they say, in light of the unnecessarily harsh result in this case, we urge the legislature to re-examine its approach. So that's Section 1 here. With respect to the offenders that would benefit from this early release program, I just want to make two quick points. One of them is that these folks have to serve half their sentence. And if they didn't have the benefit of this treatment in the institution and this possibility of early release, they would be serving two-thirds of their sentence, but they wouldn't need any treatment. So to the extent there's a controversy here, it's about the one-sixth of the person's sentence. And you'll hear, I'm sure, that there's some risk to letting somebody out. Say you have a 48-month offender. They could get out at 24 months instead of 32. Yes, they're getting out 8 months early, but they will have completed treatment in the institution. They've been screened to be a nonviolent offender, and when they get out, there are subject to random testing, electronic home monitoring, and any other conditions that the commissioner wants to impose. The other thing I'd say about those folks is that depending on where they live, they might not have gone to prison at all because they might have gone through the drug court. You know, we have 87 counties, but we only have 33 drug courts. So in those other 54 counties, some of these folks are going to prison. They stay there half their time. They complete a long treatment program, and then they get out with a bunch of conditions. So that's the gist of this bill.
Representative Eastland, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is basically current law with a minor modification that's expiring. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I guess the definition of minor is what you want to go on. One of the things that we're doing also in the bill is we're creating a panel, a three-judge panel appointed by the Supreme Court, to actually serve as a screening panel for people that would go out on CRP, and then the commissioner then would just give a thumbs up or thumbs down for people that qualify. So I think we're kind of spreading out some of the decision-making for who would be involved in the CRP program.
All right. It's my understanding that Mr. Chris from the department would like to testify. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and keep in mind that we do have one more bill as well today.
Madam Chair, my name is David Christ. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here today to speak in opposition of the extension of the CRP program. The department would much prefer that these offenders participate in our challenge incarceration program as opposed to the conditional release program. The other thing I would speak to is the three-judge panel deciding on making a recommendation on the tail end who should be released. We think it's fairer to offenders to screen them for admission to the program in the first place and not give them some false hope that
if they participate in the program, if they complete the program, that then they would be released. If those offenders, as is still in the bill, is if those offenders were involved in criminal gang activity while they were incarcerated, if they had an inappropriate custody level while they were incarcerated, or a level of risk of violence, they shouldn't be in the program to begin with, only to have their hopes dashed at the very end by a negative recommendation. And finally, I would mention that we don't think that there are a lot of offenders that are eligible for this type of program. Minnesota incarcerates fewer persons per capita than all but one state in the country. We have the sixth highest use of probation and intermediary sanctions in the country, and we're among the lowest use of minimum custody offenders, the kind of guy that should be in a program like this, in the country. And so it just doesn't add up that there's a lot of folks that are eligible to participate here.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will keep my comments brief. There's a whole series of criteria that go through that to make somebody eligible for the CRP program. And one of the things, as far as in challenge incarceration, not everyone is adapted to go to a boot camp setting. It may be age, it may be some physical difficulties, some mental difficulties, and to let individuals who have some physical or mental or age concerns going to challenge incarceration, it's really unfair to keep them out of this type of program. As far as the criteria go for screening, you must apply and meet the statutory criteria, and I'm not going to go through those. Commissioner,
excuse me, if you could state your name for the record, you didn't.
My name is Dan Knuth, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Great.
As far as the screening process goes, the person must apply for the mandatory criteria, or would you screened out? They would apply for the discretionary, would be part of their application criteria, or they wouldn't make that, they would be screened out. The prosecutors and sentencing court have some input on this as well. There's a behavioral review, there's a team review, and then the offender signs off on the criteria. And the final step is when the commissioner makes the recommendation. And at this point, there are only 43 individuals who have made it through the entire program and were released. One was returned because of violating the conditions of release, and three were restructured for community at the community level. So as far as recidivism, this has been incredibly positive. As far as the numbers go, there's some interesting things that may or may not be in here, and I'm not a numbers person, and I couldn't figure out exactly how this would work out. If you take 43 people at $30,000, there's about $1.3 million that's saved in beds if they would get at least 1 year taken off of their term. The release planning, it costs a fair amount of money, but that's being done for any inmate. There's intensive supervision that's part of that, which is about $600,000. So I think the avoided cost of about $200,000 is low based on what the Department of Corrections is saying. We recommend that that there be an extension for at least 2 years, and the commissioner has an advisory panel of three retired judges to review these cases, review these individuals, and to recommend the commissioner's either rejection or acceptance of the findings.
Thank you. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I am here. I want to thank Representative Eastland. We had a chance to discuss this matter briefly beforehand, and for his willingness to work on the language here. What you're seeing here are some cherry-picked portions of the work of the Controlled Substance Working Group that was put together by the legislature last year. I will let the committee know that the entire recommendations, those that were agreed upon, have been introduced as House File 1596 by Representative Olin. I don't know, Mr. Stewart, that it's very usual that I'm the optimist and you're the pessimist, but in this case, there was more agreement than I think Mr. Stewart is given credit for. Law enforcement, community groups were able to reach agreement and compromise on a number of issues, and I think it's important to understand that those were all considered as a package. As to the first part of this bill, the concern we have is that that is a recommendation that was not adopted by this working group. And one of the primary reasons it was not adopted was feedback from community members. In the metro areas, the reality is that people aren't going to jail for 6 months. What happens is the judge imposes the 6 months, stays it, but it is the hammer over the head that forces many people into treatment, and the community members on the committee made that very clear, that simply telling them go to treatment without the hammer behind that wasn't sufficient, and that is in large measure why it did not pass. And so we have concerns about including that. As to the second part, the expansion of the conditional release program, I think Mr. Stewart is exactly right. That is something that garnered virtually unanimous support by the working group. And while the changes here, particularly with a three-judge panel, that is something that I've been aware of for about 10 minutes and haven't had a chance to review any of the fiscal costs. That piece, again, you're cherry-picking a piece from an entire recommendation that dealt with controlled substance laws, changing thresholds for a variety of drugs. And one of the key pieces, I will tell you, is that all of the money in this proposal, any savings, stay with the state. In the working group's proposal, that money or the savings as a result of changes to the controlled substance thresholds were split between the state for treatment and local corrections for increased treatment and probation supervision, and that was a key piece. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm actually going to ask you this quick before you leave the table. Representative Bingham has a bill that's on the agenda. We're supposed to be out of this room. Is there any way you can come back tomorrow or the next day?
I will make myself available at the committee's budget.
All right. Thank you. Representative Eastland,
I don't need to make any more comments. I mean, I just think the CRP program has been a program that has been very, very meaningful for a number of people, and I think it has great potential, and I think we should be looking at continuing it.
All those in favor? Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 1126, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee with the recommendation that it go to Public Safety and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Division has been requested. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Or raise your hand, sorry. And those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Eastland.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to move Representative Bingham's bill to a different day, and this meeting is adjourned.